today on Ag News Daily.
Focus for trading for ethanol, and we saw the basis for Rule 11 spike about 6 months ago. So if you're exposed to that basis, obviously, you need to find a way to mitigate your risk.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Delaney Howell here on the Ag News Daily podcast, joined by Elaine Cubb. We've got Elaine on again this week because it's International Women's Day, so I felt it was fitting to have a woman co-host with me. Elaine, thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thanks for bringing women's voices to agriculture, Delaney. You do a good job of representing.
Oh, thank you. So do you.
Well, yeah. I think it's good that, when I was thinking about the International Women's Day, you know, I think there's sort of a story going around agriculture that women are more active now, or you see more women now. And I don't know that that's necessarily true, right? There have always been. I think my mother
and
grandmother.
Maybe it's more publicized now.
I think women are more willing to claim the roles that they've always been doing. I've always seen women working cattle and helping in the field or working in the field. And I think especially in International Women's Day, I think there is probably a...
And it's my understanding that actually 60 to 80% of the food that's produced all around the world, so internationally, a majority of the actual food that's grown in agriculture is done by women.
Well, I am not surprised by that, because especially when you look in countries like in Africa, it's so common for the women to be the main preparers of food, the ones that are going to gather the food, because the men are trying to work to have some sort of income, but the women are the ones that are tending to the gardens or to their farm and agricultural production, so I'm not surprised by that at all.
Yep, that's what we see out in the rest of the world. And
maybe the U.S. is the U.S. maybe is not the norm as far as that goes.
Yeah, I used to think so. I went to Africa a couple of times to do grain market development trips, and I was going to say that the United States is actually farther behind in getting women to agriculture meetings, because you'd go to the meetings about the grain markets, and they were largely attended by women, which is great. And we don't see that at market meetings in the Midwest.
Yeah,
I
mean, when
that
we travel around, I'm sure you see it too. When you're traveling and speaking to farm groups, it's men.
Yeah.
And majority are like 40 plus. But not a lot of women.
I see more and more women, which is good. But So I was going to say, oh, maybe Africa's really ahead of us on the game. But they have their own problems. It's like the women would come to the meeting but then not be willing to speak up because they don't want to speak up in front of their neighbors and cousins and uncles and such. So I think that's true of U.S. farm women, is if they do come to the meeting, they're the ones
speaking.
They're
not afraid to ask questions.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, it's exciting. Happy International Women's Day to all of our Ag News Daily women listeners. That's for sure.
For sure.
Well, Elaine, should we just get right to the WASDE report? We had that come out earlier this afternoon. What were the big surprises there? I don't know that I was surprised by any... Actually, I was surprised by one thing, and that is the increase in U.S. corn ending stocks.
Yeah, I was surprised by it, too. The market wasn't terribly surprised.
Right.
We didn't get a huge reaction price-wise, which is good. But yeah, they increased it 100 million bushels.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know why? What did they do?
Well, from what I can tell, because they pulled down ethanol production and exports.
That's fair. Well, the ethanol thing is fair. I mean, there's evidence that you know, stuttering some of these plants and the profitability situation isn't phenomenal for ethanol. So that makes sense. But the exports, I thought we were doing quite well.
I know. I was surprised by that. And it's very fitting that we're having that ethanol discussion today, because for today's Friday episode, I actually got to interview an ethanol trader. He does physical ethanol trades and on the paper, too. So interesting and timely for today. We did have this conversation before the WASDE came out, because we had originally scheduled it for 11, and it's like, oh, crap, we probably shouldn't talk then, because we've got to look at the markets and watch the WASDE there. So.
Well, I'm really looking forward to hearing that interview, because getting ethanol traded around the world and exported, that is huge.
Yeah,
that is
we talked about
huge opportunity
that
for the corn market to be exporting corn in all forms.
Yeah, and he flat out says, I don't want to give too much of the interview away, but he said, you know, we've hit our, like, he said, this is an unpopular opinion, but he thinks we've hit our stride for ethanol. There's really no more increase in domestic supply, or in domestic demand right now, even with E15. It's really got to be from a pickup in exports, and probably a pickup from exports to China.
Yeah, Asian countries. Well, that's really similar to some of the livestock markets, too, right, where we don't expect to see a big change in domestic demand. We don't expect a boost from that, but we do expect to see continued and more international demand for our good beef products and pork products.
Yeah, absolutely. So other than that surprise to me. What was there that jumped out that you think's worth mentioning from highlights from this WASDE report?
I would sort of be picky about their Brazilian soybean production number, which I think they put at 117.5.
Yeah, I think that's right, 0.5. Uh-huh.
Yeah, which I think some private estimates and just stories on the ground make you think that it will still come down from that. It could be as low as 113.5.
Okay.
We could see that in future months, and that's a pretty typical way for the USDA to do it, is to make these changes very conservatively, mm-hmm. very slowly. So I think that might help to explain why the soybean market sort of discounted that rather bearish number.
Okay. Those are the big takeaways for you, though.
Yeah.
Okay. We've also got the cattle on feed report coming on at 2. I'm going to save that for Monday's market discussion because I'm not going to just throw you to the wolves on that one.
Well, I haven't seen it yet. We don't
well,
know.
I know. We don't know. At this point in time, we haven't seen it yet. But when it does come out, we'll just save that for Monday.
Yeah, going into it, the cash business that was transacted on Thursday was just steady with last week. And we saw, you know, a cold storage report that showed expanding supplies of beef in cold storage. So I think the packers, unless something really strangely bullish comes out of that cattle on feed report, which is not expected, I think the packers have the upper hand here to keep things stable.
Okay. All right. Well, we will talk about that on Monday. Just jumping into some news for today, other than today's WASDE report, I've seen reports today, Elaine, that said that March 27th rumored meeting that was supposed to happen in Florida is not going to happen now at the end of March. Are you hearing that as well?
Yeah, the Financial Times reported that now it has been, the March thing is off the table, and now it's just some unknown future date, just some date down the road.
There seems to be a common theme with Chinese negotiations about, you know, they promised to make this purchase, but on down the road we don't know a date.
Yeah,
it seems like
sometime down the road.
Yeah, and is that why we had such a, I guess, boring week in the soybean markets in particular until today? Really, we didn't see a lot of volatility this week because of no trade news.
Or trade news that just keeps on being delayed. We do still see, like, in the soybean options market, there still seems to be this expectation that someday down the road, someday there will be a boost in soybeans that would bring it back into line with their historical ratio to corn. But not today, not this week, like you mentioned. Everything's just pretty flat.
Well, in talking about that, too, that getting back to that corn to soybeans ratio, I've been having a lot of discussions, and I feel like you and I have talked about this, too, the future of the hemp industry. And there's a little bit of news today related to that. There's a coalition of farmers and industry stakeholders essentially working to form a trade organization or a commodity group, is from my understanding, that they're going to set up there and represent that commodity in the nation's capital. I've been having this discussion, quite frankly, with a lot of traders and producers saying, you know, once we get the regulatory thing figured out, once USDA sets some guidelines and figures out how do you determine the difference between hemp and marijuana, I've had people say they think even states like Iowa could just move away from soybeans and start growing other products like hemp and corn and make those two the top commodities for the state.
I don't know what acreage necessarily would be required to meet whatever the ultimate demand is. So I don't know that I'm expecting it to be the next soybeans.
Right.
But certainly it could become part of the mix. And I think that's fantastic that they're forming a trade group, because that's very much needed, I think, among the politicians, that ignorance, like you mentioned, of not knowing the difference between the two varieties.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we see, as a case study, think of the good work that the corn growers have been doing, National Corn Growers Association, Iowa Corn Growers. This week I did a couple of events for Iowa Corn Growers, and just highlighting the trade development work that they do, going to Mexico, going to other countries, that the ethanol, again, the upcoming interview.
Yeah.
So if you had a group like that for hemp that was helping politicians understand the market and building the market, helping processors getting some funding, getting everything up and running, that would be absolutely crucial to making that a real deal option for farmers
to
include.
Right, and maybe giving it, legality is not the word I'm looking for, maybe give it
legitimacy?
Some more leg. Yeah, legitimacy. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So that's what I had on the hemp front. When we're talking about things on the trade front, it looks like we're seeing some, I guess, news-ish come out about the EU trade deal. One thing I thought was interesting today, Cecilia Malmström, who is, of course, the EU's trade commissioner, made comments that the EU also supports what the U.S. is doing with China and also believes that we need to hold them accountable and really come together, you know, on one front to make China play by the same rules as everybody else. I thought that was interesting that she publicly made a comment saying, here's the exact quote I was looking for, we are committed to tackling the distorting practices of China, and we must make sure trade remains free and fair. It is clear that no matter what happens in terms of our relationship bilaterally, we must continue to work together on China and the WTO.
Absolutely, and I think, so the Europe's in that, other countries, Canada is obviously on our side in
right.
this one. Absolutely, there is sort of an international consensus that China should rein in or control better its commercial property theft, or whatever we want to call it. Interestingly, I think I read, and I can't remember where, and I don't have the quote in front of me, you know, I'm one of those people, that so the Chinese legislative body is meeting this week, and even they, that's on their agenda, is to address it somehow, is to make, perhaps it'll just be a token gesture, maybe it won't be real reform, but they are willing to address it, or they want to at least communicate to the international world that they are going to do something different about their trade technology transfer policies. Yep.
It just still like blows my mind how they're considered a developing country. And I know that's, I think it's self-designated within the WTO rules, but it's like, how, I mean, they are still growing and developing, but they're
pretty sophisticated.
One and two. Yeah. I mean, we battle with them for number one and number two economies in the world. So how is that considered developing?
Yeah. Yeah, and you see, I mean, you see just video footage. I haven't been to China. Have you been to China?
I have not.
We should.
I know.
We should do a trade.
Let's
what do you
do
call
that.
It? A mission.
Yeah.
No, I haven't been there. But the footage you see of it's the industrialization, the skyscrapers, everything is pretty sophisticated, built up. Like you mentioned, it's not what we picture as a dirt developing nation.
Yeah. I mean, I guess they don't really show the countryside as much. They show the commercialized aspects of China when you see it in the news and in footage and stuff, but I don't know.
That's true. And I think that's another thing that their legislative body is potentially addressing in this session is the idea of getting some better agricultural finance to the rural areas that you mentioned are kind of undeveloped still. Because if they would have the ability to use their land as collateral to get equipment loans and then start growing corn and soybeans in the way that we in North America grow corn and soybeans with large equipment and large tracts of land very efficiently, that would massively increase their production capabilities and decrease their need to be buying soybeans from the United States.
So it's good and bad, probably.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, good, perhaps, I think, from a humanitarian aspect, I think it would be nice. But from a soybean trade, market share.
Yeah. And, of course, they've got a lot of ethanol in the news today. They've, of course, got that ethanol mandate by 2020, which I'm going to talk to Jordan about here in just a minute. But I thought this was a great statistic, and he does mention it, I'm pretty sure, in today's interview. U.S. ethanol exports topped 1.7 billion gallons in 2018, a 24% increase over 2017, and this is a new record year when you look at ethanol production in the country.
Wow. Good
so
for us.
We're continuing to move right along, but margins are tight now. We're seeing ethanol scale back. We're seeing plants go offline. A little uncertainty in the ethanol markets, I would say.
Yeah, and so much of it, I feel like it's dependent on the overall energy prices, crude oil prices, gasoline prices, but it's not the fault of corn prices.
No.
It's not like high-priced corn is challenging ethanol profitability, so that's good.
Yeah, that is good. Well, that's all the news I think we've got for today, folks. Let's jump over into today's commodity markets, which are sponsored by our partners at the Zahner Group. You can give them a call today at 312-277-0050 and get their take on today's WASI report. The March corn contract and beyond didn't really react to today's report, down a penny and a quarter at 354¾. The December down a half a cent at 388½. The soybean pits were the ones to take that on the chin today. The March contract down 7 cents at 883¾. The November down 6 cents at 930½. Wheat had some strength today. I don't know why. The March contract up a penny and a quarter at 432¾. The May up a penny and a quarter at 439½. Looking over at the livestock pits, we've got that cattle on feed report coming out here in just a little while. Going to talk about that on Monday. Looking into the live cattle markets, the April contract up 72½ cents on the day at 129.67½. The August up 65 cents to close at 117.17. in the feeder cattle pits. The March contract up $1.02 on the day at $143.92.5. The May up $1.45 at $148.52.5. In the lean hog pits, a nice day here on the board. Not quite limit up at $282.5. In the April contract to close at $60.55. The June up $2.65 to end at $78.17.5. And as promised, today's interview is all about ethanol with ethanol trader Jordan Fife.
Well, we're talking about ethanol production and trading today with Jordan Fife of BioUrja, who is the head of ethanol trading. Jordan, thank you so much for taking the time to fill me in on ethanol today. I'm excited about this conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having me. We're talking ethanol today. We can start with kind of the 10,000 foot view,
yeah,
if you will.
Now. I want to start with BioUrja, the company itself, because that's not one I'm familiar with. So what does BioUrja do, and what do you do as the head of ethanol trading?
Be honest with you, but joking aside, we've been trading ethanol for about 15 years here at BioUrja. I've been here 9 years. I started off as just a regular trader here, and about 2 years ago got promoted to head of ethanol trading. We trade physical ethanol along with paper ethanol, so options, swaps, and stuff like that. We trade about, if you look at it, about 2.5-3% of the United States production of physical ethanol. So we're trading rail cars, barges, we do imports and exports, and we've been doing that, like I said, for about 15 years now.
And so we've kind of entered this period, or maybe we're hopefully on the end of this period of ethanol scale back when you look at production. Was that the case for BioUrja as well?
In terms of, so right now, just again, you know, fill you in a little bit more about BioUrja. We don't have any production. We don't have any marketing agreements.
Okay, gotcha.
But we do trade the physical barrel of ethanol. If I buy it, I got to sell it. If I sell it, I got to buy it. We are a prop trading shop. But our main focus is physical trading of ethanol.
Okay, so maybe the better question then was, were you guys impacted by plants scaling back on ethanol production and folks having really tight margins in the ethanol industry?
Absolutely. So we sell in the Southeast a lot, for example, delivering to major small mom and pop gas stations, large independent gas stations. And one of the ways that we were affected was we saw a raising of the basis. Rule 11 is a large traded focus for trading for ethanol. And we saw the basis for Rule 11 spike about 6 months ago. So if you're exposed to that basis, obviously you need to find a way to mitigate your risk and move the barrel around. And I always say that the invisible hand of the market, to paraphrase Adam Smith, will move that barrel. So we saw a lot of things moving down the river. We saw a lot of logistics strained, and we saw the differentials in our markets affected by the slowing down, the lessening of production. And not only, it's not just what we saw production scale back, we saw plants completely go offline.
Yeah.
And they're not coming back. You know, Hopewell, Virginia, for example, which was a GPRE plant, is gone. And that was a 60 million gallon plant there in Virginia. We do a lot, like I said, in the Southeast, so we're in the Virginia market. And that obviously affected us there. We also are in Vicksburg, Mississippi, which is off of the Mississippi River, obviously. Ergon was a plant that was about a 57 million gallon plant that's gone. I mean, these two plants are, it's not that they've just slowed down. They've shut and are not coming back on line. I believe they're probably going to be scrapped, to be honest with you. So again, we saw a lot more barges coming down the river to Vicksburg. We saw a lot more rail into places like Richmond and Chesapeake, Virginia, to offset these plants that had such a low margin that they basically shut their doors and will never come back.
Jordan, maybe another question I should be asking too, because a lot of people haven't really maybe shared why we've seen such the tight margins in ethanol and why we've seen the scale back trickle effect. From your perspective, what happened that made ethanol, face this time of maybe uncertainty or smaller margins?
Yeah, so I think you have to kind of rewind the tape in order to answer that question, right? I mean, if you look back at like 2014, 15, and 16, At the DOE's numbers, the Department of Energy, they release how much ethanol we produce every single week, right? If you look back at 14, 15, and 16, we were averaging like, you know, 9 million gallons per day of production. But between 2016 and 17, we ramped up to like 232, mm-hmm. 233. And then by 2018, we were at like 10 million, 10.5 million is about what we're averaging so far throughout 2018. So we had a giant increase in production in ethanol and really explored, you know, once you have that, there's only two things that can really happen. Domestically, we're going to have to take more, which mm-hmm. we are a little bit, or you're going to have to export more. We kind of hit a wall with exports, in my opinion. Last year, they just came out with this data, actually. We exported about 1 in 10 gallons of ethanol. And that's a lot. It's the most ever. 2018 was the most we've ever exported as a country. But there's really not a new market outside of China, which
right.
I'll talk about later. it's a big one to talk about, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, so my opinion is we had this giant ramp up in production, and we've kind of hit a ceiling for how much we can produce and how much we can do. And then the other side of it is, you know, like I said, domestically we can take so much, and obviously E15, E85, higher blends, and I'm sure we can discuss that as well. But once you hit that wall, the margin is going to get squeezed, and that's what we're seeing right now.
Okay, that makes sense. I mean, you don't have increased demand, but we have increased supply. So let's talk about China, since you opened that door. Obviously, there's a lot of uncertainty there on the trade front. We've got a lot of issues to resolve. But at the end of the day, I think most folks agree China can't produce the amount of ethanol they need to meet their ethanol mandate by, I think, it's 2020. Let's say we don't even take up all of that market share, but just a portion of it. How much can that help us increase ethanol exports?
No, it's a big number, because if you go back again to, I want to say it was 2016, I don't have all the facts and figures mm-hmm. in front of me, but I'm almost positive. In 2016, China was almost like 20% of our ethanol exports. The very next year, it was like 5%.
Oh, wow.
And this is a big drop, right? And if you remember, the reason that it went down in 2017 versus 2016, pre-tariff wars and everything mm-hmm. like that, China put a 30% tariff on United States ethanol. They started off, this is again before any of the stuff that's going on right now, and that really affected us. Now, the good news was, is, you know, once again, the invisible hand of the market kind of moved around and we started exporting more. But if they come back and they're good for, you know, I think it was like $300 million in revenue was the last I saw the number of pre-tariffs on China. So the number's big. It's a significant amount of ethanol that they could start taking right away. And as you said, which I completely agree with, there's 0% chance that they're going to be able to meet their mandate by 2020 for an E10. It's just, it's literally impossible. They don't have the corn. They don't have the production facilities. We are in the best position to export to them of anybody.
And with that, let's say we do start to, not even a lion's share of ethanol exports to China. Let's say we get a trade deal in place, we start exporting ethanol to China. What do you see that doing for ethanol basis, and then in turn, kind of the trickle-down effect into the corn market?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think immediately it will list, you know, the people that have the ability to make China spec, the ability for the people that have the ability to export. But again, that's kind of going to pull away from some of the other guys. You know, UT and DN unit train destinations, that's going to pull up their margins. It's going to start pulling down the stocks. And if you look at stocks, mm-hmm. I mean, over the last year, we've just been building stocks every single week. The stocks to use ratio is going up. So that's going to draw that down. As it draws that down, you know, we're going to be in a much better position as a country that's, you know, producing a lot of ethanol. In terms of corn, that should absolutely help the corn price. You know, I don't know about board, but basis-wise, for anyone that lives
right near an ethanol facility,
yeah, exactly. And then that circle just becomes a little bit bigger, where they need more corn to produce more. So it is a positive impact for everybody, and I think everybody in ethanol wants to see a trade deal get done mm-hmm. Sooner rather than later.
Absolutely. So the stocks-to-use ratio that you're mentioning there, is that a concern for you long-term if we don't see
increased demand, either domestically, which maybe we've hit a peak there, or export-wise?
Absolutely. And you know, the old adage, of course, and everybody's heard it, is low prices fix low prices, high prices fix high prices. Mm-hmm. Well, the same is, you know, true for margin. You know, it's gonna start shutting more plants or slowing more plants. It's the only way, the only other side of that equation, right? A smarter man than me once said, time plus pain equals rationalization. And I think we've defined time, and I think we've seen pain as well. Without something new, we're just going to see more plants slowing down or potentially shutting down, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, it is. I like all your adages there. Those are fun. I think really the other big piece of this ethanol puzzle that we really, you mentioned it, but we really haven't addressed yet, is the E15 year-round sales. We don't know, of course, there's uncertainty there from the administration if we're going to get it this year, if we're not going to get it by June 1st. But let's say we do get it by June 1st. Is it really going to change the ethanol balance sheet that much?
And this is an unpopular opinion, by the way, but it's one that I'm willing to discuss.
Okay.
But I think no.
Okay.
I have talked to people in Growth Energy. I've talked to people in the RFA.
Mm-hmm.
The best analysis that I've read, and you know, I actually used to work in retail gasoline prior to working here. The best numbers I've seen is about 100 million extra gallons immediately with the existing infrastructure that we have.
And can you put that in perspective, 100 million extra gallons, what's that? Compare
one
that
to ethanol plant.
Okay.
It's one ethanol plant. And unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, we have two ethanol plants coming online this year.
Mm.
Already have in Atlantic, Iowa. Mm-hmm. And Rigneck. And Atlantic is, I want to say, 140 million gallon plant. And Rigneck is, I want to say, 80 million. So it won't even negate what we have coming online on E15. Now, that's the immediate effect, and I get that. You know, that's the unfortunate side. Let's paint a little bit rosier picture.
Okay.
For everybody. Yeah, because I don't want everybody to get mad at me.
Right? Yeah.
And they'll probably find me on Twitter or something. Everybody's going to yell at me. Let's not do that. So, again, it takes the first step, and the ability to do that, you know, first step to have the E15 is a win. It's just, frankly, a win. It's something that people have been fighting a long time for. So if you have that and you know, we have a low ethanol to RBOB spread, which is gasoline, and you can get that flashy number at the pump that is way lower than just your other alternatives, you're going to start moving more. And then it becomes a marketing, it becomes advertising. And I know people, again, I worked in retail gasoline previously. How do they have more success? What do they need to label it as? Where do they put the price? These little things add up big. When you show it on the one, because we all drive by gas stations every day, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you see, you know, $1.89 or $2 for gasoline, and then you see right below it the premium and the diesel. If you have another number on there that's way lower that says, you know, E15 and it is 20 cents lower, that starts to move product a lot faster than when you get up to the pump and there's an extra handle or an extra button. People are just confused by that. When they see a low price, people are drawn to it. It's just marketing 101. So, again, the first step is not an immediate, like, windfall for
ethanol.
It's 100 million gallons-ish, which is nice, you know. And where we're at right now in stocks use will take anything. It's going to be years to come to see the real effect, in my opinion, of what it means to ethanol.
Well, and I think the other question that I've kind of had or posed to quite a few folks in the ethanol or E15 discussion is, when you look outside of the Midwest especially, it doesn't seem like you see E15 or E10 at the pumps. Is it that effect, too, that we need to see the East Coast and the West Coast, or maybe the South or Southeast, adopt that E10 or E15 at the pump?
Absolutely. And, you know, and again, I was actually born in Indiana, so I love all the Midwest folks and everything like that. But unfortunately, when you look at population density, Midwest versus East Coast and West Coast, it's just there's more people that live in the East Coast and West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
So your demand is higher in, you know, East Coast, West Coast. And I currently reside in Houston, Texas, and along where we live right now, I mean, I can tell you my commute in today was terrible, so there's plenty of people that live here. But joking aside, you're 100% correct. We need a bigger saturation of E15, E85, higher blends in these large population areas, you know, the Northeast, the Southeast, and the West Coast. I did go to California not that long ago, and there was a couple places that did have advertised. And I think that has to do with the low carbon fuel standard, the LCFS. So they were kind of moving along there, which is good. But for every one of those I also saw an electric car charging. So I think those probably negate each other on the West Coast a little bit.
Yeah, probably. Well, Jordan, definitely going to have you back on to talk ethanol again. If folks want to interact with you on Twitter because they have some questions or thoughts spurred by this conversation, how can they reach you?
Well, that's very nice of you. Thanks for asking. I'm JordanFife1 on Twitter. And, I might not know the answer to all the questions, but I'll try to find someone that does if I don't.
Awesome. Jordan, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. This is a lot of fun.
Well, interesting discussion there with Jordan. I think it's so fascinating to learn about trading the physical and the paper because, I mean, a lot of folks that we have on the podcast are only doing the paper.
Yeah. Oh, and I think that it's so important. Like, that's where you really get to see the underpinnings, the nuts and bolts.
Yeah.
And knowing that helps you predict things that can happen in, you know, when you hear potentially geopolitical news.
Right.
Like he mentions, you know, where does the ethanol go? So now our relationships with those countries affect the ethanol market in ways that they didn't maybe 5 years ago even.
Yeah, interesting stuff.
Very interesting.
Elaine, I've got to ask, when are you going to write your Mastering the Livestock Markets book?
Well, great question.
Not to put you on the spot here.
I keep on saying that, I don't know, for the past 5 years, I'll do it. And when I feel like there's going to be a really robust market for it, I guess.
Okay, a really robust market. Elaine, if folks want to interact with you on Twitter, how can they do that?
I am on Twitter at Elaine Cub. Cub is spelled K-U-B. Or www.masteringthegrainmarkets.com. You can always find me on the internet.
Awesome. Elaine Cub, happy International Women's Day, and thanks for co-hosting with me today. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Delaney. Have a good one.